the studios of KPCW. This is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. This morning we speak first with Sumanth Subramanian, a freelance writer who has written in this month's Wired magazine an article about Velez, Macedonia, where a groundswell of fake news sprung during the 2016 election. How did it get started? Who was the audience? There must be money involved. Where did that come from, Mr. Google?
And then, have you ever solved a Rubik's Cube? Remember the Rubik's Cube? Well, have you ever solved it in less than 30 seconds? That little cube was invented in Hungary in 1974 by a gentleman who put it together with wood blocks, rubber bands, and paper clips. He didn't know if it could be solved, let alone that it would become the world's most popular puzzle. We speak with a storyteller, Ian Scheffler, who has written a book about the Rubik's Cube. It's called Cracking the Cube.
And finally, we speak with Suzanne Scraggin of the Hogle Zoo in Salt Lake, who's been prepping kids in the Park City School District all week for the arrival of Jeff Corwin at the Eccles Center on Saturday. These three guests plus today's cool story when we return. This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Velez, Macedonia was made famous, or shall I say infamous, as one of the birthplaces of fake news, you know, alternative facts. And our next guest, Sumanth Subramanian, in an article in the March edition of Wired magazine, takes on the subject by exploring the town, its economy, and why one 18-year-old named Boris began sharing fake news surrounding the American presidential election. Samaradian writes for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The National, and now with this wonderfully fascinating article in Wired magazine this month. Sumanth, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful to have you. And I think I almost made it through the pronunciation of your name, but
You got it completely right.
Okay, good. Good. Well, so take us to Velez, Macedonia, and set the scene for why this town becomes infamous for, you know, a groundspring of fake news.
Well, I mean, I think people started learning about this town back in maybe August or September last year. There were a couple of news reports about how there were all these websites that were devoted to pro-Trump fake news. And, you know, you can go on these internet registry sites and see where these sites are registered. And more than 150 of them were tracked back to this little town called Velez in Macedonia, which no one had heard of. Now, of course, there were fake news websites registered in other towns around the world as well, but it seemed kind of odd. I mean, why should there be so many, you know, dozens and dozens of sites registered by people out of Velez? And so, you know, so this was sort of the little news article that came out sometime in the summer and the fall of last year. And this got me thinking, you know, there has to be a reason as to why all these Macedonians in this town are starting to set these sites up. So I traveled there in December, and I met a few people who run these sites or ran these sites. I spent a lot of time with one 18-year-old who I called Boris in the story because he wanted to remain anonymous. And I found out that the town is really sort of, you know, it's a decaying town. It used to be vibrant and full of industry at one point of time, about 30 or 40 years ago. All of that has melted away. Kids who are living in the town don't really have prospects to look forward to. They have to leave town to get any sort of work. There's not much to do. You know, there's no movie theater in the town, for example. That's shut down. The football club isn't doing so well. So it's just sort of a moribund town. And these websites represented a way for these kids who had internet, after all, even if they didn't have anything else, represented a way for them to make really, really good money with just sort of very little effort and energy.
So in Boris's case, as you call him, he's made about $16,000 between, August and November, and that's looking up against the monthly wage in Macedonia, which is about, $375 a month?
That's right.
Okay. And, you know, how does he get the idea? I mean, these kids, as you say, they have a lot of time on their hands with not a lot to do. They do have, I assume it's free internet access, and they've got some sort of system hobbled together. What's the nemesis, the catalyst behind this?
Well, I mean, it turns out that running these kind of websites is a sort of cottage industry, not about politics in particular, but just about any topic in general. And here's how it works. If you realize that there's a lot of people out there who want to read about cars, for example, or who want news about health food, or who want news about fashion and celebrities, just like gossip, you know, what you would do is you would set up a website and you would copy the content from other websites around the internet, you know, websites devoted to cars or whatever, just copy paste the content onto your own website. But then you build these ads into your website. You get Google Ads. Very simple. It's just sort of a little snippet of code. You put it into the template of your website. And then the more you publicize the website, the more people come onto the website, and some of them will end up clicking on the ad. And every single ad that is clicked on earns you like a little, you know, maybe a few cents. Now, a few cents doesn't sound like a lot, but if you're not doing anything else with your life, and if you're living in a small town and you have a lot of time to devote to this, you know, the cents build up into dollars, and the dollars build up into tens or maybe hundreds of dollars. And in a country like Macedonia, that goes a long way. So people had been doing this in Veles and elsewhere in Macedonia even before the U.S. election. They'd been doing it with other sorts of websites. But I think the trick that people figured out during the election itself is that there was a certain sort of segment of Americans who wanted news that spun Trump in a particular way, that took down Hillary Clinton in a particular way, and they were willing to sort of share these links around and come and click on these links because they were avid for this kind of news. So he would get the fake news from somewhere else, maybe an American website or maybe somewhere else, and he would just copy and paste the text. He didn't even have to make the news up.
So for our listeners, I just want to mention that this is Wired magazine. The article appeared in Wired in the March 2017 issue. And when Boris was making $16,000 between August and November of last year, I just want to clarify, that was with just two pro-Trump websites. Is that correct?
That's right. Just two.
That's amazing. And in addition to taking other stories and putting them on their websites and hoping that people would do the advertising clicks, they were also providing content. They were writing stories themselves. Is that correct?
Well, they would sort of, you know, they would take little bits off different stories and they would just sort of put them together. I mean, these kids didn't speak very good English, so it was very difficult for them to sort of spin a story from scratch, you know, just make it up and write the whole thing. So they would take maybe sort of a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and somehow managed to patch it together.
Okay. And your story in Macedonia, is this something very unique, or is this the microcosm of a much bigger picture? Is this happening everywhere?
Well, I definitely don't think it's unique. I think, as I mentioned, this cottage industry of building websites just to get people to come and click on the ads and make a little money, I think that's sort of pretty widespread. And this works particularly well because Google is an American company, so it pays in dollars when people click on your Google ad. And similarly, you know, there's like a hierarchy of users. So, for example, if you attract American or Western European users to your website and they click on your ad, you get, you know, a higher percentage of money. So this seems to be a thing all over the developing world. I mean, not just Eastern Europe, but also Asia, maybe Africa. It's just sort of common in places where there's not a lot to do, but you have an internet connection and you figure maybe this is something that you can use to make a little money.
Right. What do you think this says about who we are as Americans and our how gullible we are when we just drink up and consume this kind of news at a pretty awesome clip? I mean, it says something about the passion and the emotion surrounding the election, no doubt. But there are certain factions, as you point out in your article, that receive this kind of stuff differently.
Well, I think there's two things to it here. I mean, the first thing is, I mean, there's no doubt that Republicans who were supporting Trump during the election last year felt that the kind of news they wanted to see, they weren't really seeing in the mainstream media. I mean, they weren't getting it off NPR. They weren't reading it in the New York Times. You know, there were a few sites like Breitbart, for example, that would sort of spin the news in a way that seemed to boost Trump. But by and large, there weren't that many websites or magazines or radio stations out there doing this. So I think there was a particular hunger for that kind of news in a particular segment of American voters. But then the second thing also is just has to do with how all of us consume media in this day and age, right? It's not just Americans, but everybody seems to come to news articles from their social media bubbles. And that social media bubble means that you kind of follow like-minded people on Twitter, your friends with like-minded people on Facebook. And so they all feed you the same kind of self-reinforcing news cycle that you're already a part of. And you know, in turn, you feed it onwards. So I think we all have to seriously rethink how we get news and all, because, I mean, if we're relying on our echo chambers to feed us news, and if our echo chambers turn out to be wrong, as they are in the case of these Macedonian websites, well, then you'll never know. You'll just kind of keep reading and digesting this news without realizing that it's completely fake.
Right. So what happens to Boris? You talk about sort of the evolution of his sites and how he reposts all of this news onto various Facebook pages that I think are mostly based in this country. Is that right?
That's right.
Right. And so, but then it all comes to sort of a grinding halt, literally right after the election. It must have fascinated you in some way to see how the Google and Facebooks of the world didn't pick up on this earlier.
That's right. I think, I mean, they were okay with sort of people building websites for profit. I mean, that's one thing. But then the enormous amount of coverage that fake news got during the election, I think that prompted Google to pull the plug on a lot of these ads that were served on fake news websites.
And Sumanth, just to be clear, Boris and his comrades are not politically motivated. They're just motivated for money, right?
That's pretty much it. I mean, they don't know much about the American election. I mean, they know there's somebody called Donald Trump and somebody called Hillary Clinton, but they don't necessarily know sort of the nuances of their policy positions. And they don't have a vested interest in, you know, in which candidate became the American president. So you're right. It was just purely because they were making money off of the website.
And this is fascinating. Towards the end there of the campaign, our current president, Barack Obama, the current president at the time, he spent some time almost obsessively talking about Velez and its digital gold rush, as he called it.
Mm-hmm.
So he was completely in tune to this thing, and there was nothing he could do about it.
Right. I mean, in a sense, I guess there's really very, very little anybody can do about it because this is just the nature of the internet itself. It's sort of out of any one person's control. And usually that's what makes it so valuable and enriching. But it also sort of comes with this dark side where it enables this kind of behavior.
Right. You have a graphic in your article talking about reputable sources and the percentage of Americans who trust the information. Local news, 82% they trust. Friends and family, 77%. National news, 76%. But when it gets to social media, people are starting to get hip, where only 34% believe that they trust the information that they get from social media. Do you think that number will go down? Or, excuse me,
well, I mean,
go down.
Well, I mean, I hope so, because I think, like, it's not so much that social media by itself is sort of an instrument of propagation of fake news, right? I mean, it's just, in the end, social media is just a tool. I think what really needs to happen is every time people read a news story, whether it's in the New York Times or anywhere else, there's a, if you read it attuned to sort of the underlying layers and nuances of it, you automatically becoming more questioning. And look, I mean, I think everybody should question the New York Times as well. But there are some news outlets that deserve to be questioned more than others.
Right. Do you know, I guess what we're up against here is knowing the difference between what we would call a bias, whether a liberal or conservative bias, where you may say something like the New York Times has a liberal bias, whereas the Wall Street Journal has a bit of a conservative bias. There's a huge difference between a bias and something that is not credible. And it comes back to fact-checking and the amount of fact-checking that is done at these in these media outlets. But it seems that people don't know the difference between what may just be a bias and what's fake, what's credible.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us in the media in particular had a real problem with the word or the term fake news as it was used during and after the election, because people started to refer to any kind of news they didn't agree with as fake news. And this goes right from sort of the average person on Twitter right up to the president, who recently called CNN fake news, right? Now, I mean, just because news comes from a particular ideological standpoint doesn't in itself make it fake. And just because it questions what you believe in doesn't make it fake. What happened in Veles in Macedonia really was fake news. I mean, this was news that was sort of, there was no reporting out there. It was just completely made up, utterly false in every single point. And it was made up purely to help a particular candidate win an election. Now, in that particular case, I think the term fake news really applies. But there's sort of a taxonomy of falsity here that we need to also be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the end, a couple things about Boris. He feels, well, tell us what he feels about Bernie Sanders supporters when he tried out, because he experimented around a bit with fake news. And what did he find there?
He played around. I mean, I think it was sometime last July where he thought maybe he would start posting sort of fake articles that boosted Bernie Sanders. So he did a few of these. And the thing he told me was that, you know, it was very difficult to get people to click on them or buy these stories because they wanted more proof. Bernie Sanders supporters, he said, are very smart. They always want more proof.
Yeah. And what does that then say about Trump supporters? That was a rhetorical question. You don't need to answer that unless you want to.
No, I want to come back to the U.S. at some point, so I shouldn't say anything.
Exactly.
Sort of an interesting thing if you look at, it didn't happen yesterday that all of a sudden people decided that telling the truth was not that important, but it's happened over a period of years. But there just seems to be in our society not as much truth telling. It's just sort of a bigger picture. It's kind of an interesting thing to study.
And it's also a paradox, because I would have thought with the internet out there, it makes it so much easier to find out what the real facts are, right? I mean, you can't. It's really hard to lie when there's so much information out there. But paradoxically, it seems to be going in the opposite direction. That, you know, with all this information out there, people get more and more bewildered, and in a way, maybe they're sort of more easily lied to now than they were earlier.
Our guest is Sumanth Subramanian, and really interesting collection of essays and a couple books you've written. I was cruising around your website last night. Very interesting. And this article is called Welcome to Veles, Macedonia, Fake News Factory to the World, in this month's, in the March edition of Wired magazine. And Sumanth, thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to talking to you again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Lynn.
And this is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We are about to have a great conversation about the Rubik's Cube. And maybe after this conversation, John and I, maybe we'll get our very own Rubik's Cube. Stay with us. It's Cool Science.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchford from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Invented in 1974 by the reclusive Hungarian architect Erno Rubik, the Rubik's Cube was invented in his mother's apartment. Wooden blocks, rubber bands, paper clips, all that kind of stuff went into it. The puzzle was famously popular in the 80s. It's since come roaring back, inspiring competitions around the world. Did you miss the wave in the 80s? Well, now's your chance for a redo. Speed cubing, in fact, exists at competitions everywhere. The record for the quickest solve of the Rubik's Cube? Well, we'll find out from our next guest, Ian Scheffler, a storyteller, writer, who has written a book, Cracking the Code, Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. Scheffler has written for The New Yorker and The Guardian, and he has an enviable Rubik's Cube solve time. Welcome, Ian, to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I never had my own Rubik's Cube, but I wrestled with one for an hour once at a party many years ago, and I was pretty frustrated by it. But there is so much on the internet now about different tricks or different ways to solve the cube. Has that had something to do with the new popularity where people or the renewed popularity where people can now solve this puzzle?
Absolutely. It's so much easier than ever before to learn to solve the puzzle. I mean, back in the 80s, before the internet was in wide use, a pair of brothers in Menlo Park in California actually patented something called the Cube Smasher, which was just literally a plastic mallet. And it came with an instructional manual about all the different ways you could destroy the puzzle out of your frustration. So, you know, you can hop on YouTube now. You can listen to podcasts. There's all kinds of ways to learn your way around the puzzle now.
And you mentioned in your book that Lucas Etter from Kentucky holds the world record for the quickest single solve, 4.9 seconds, and he's only 14 years old. Whole thing kind of blows my mind until in the green room this morning with Lynn, I was taking a peek at the web, and I found that a robot can now solve a Rubik's Cube in, I think it's 0.01 seconds or something like that. Oh, it's 0.637 seconds, and there's a video of this robot. I mean, it's pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean, I like to say it isn't really a fair race because the robot essentially has six hands. It's, you know, just like six metal rods, one stuck to each side of the Rubik's Cube. But what's really funny is that humans keep getting faster. Since I wrote the book, the record's been broken twice, and it's down to just 4.73 seconds now.
So really, it is a feat of the ability to move your fingers quickly rather than figuring out or learning the algorithm and the math behind the Rubik's Cube. Is that right?
No, it's actually both. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, in the same way that the reason Usain Bolt is the fastest runner in the world, it's both because he can move his legs fast and because he can take such large strides. A lot of it has to do with, you know, the very complex mathematics of the cube and finding the most efficient solution because, you know, no matter how fast you can move your fingers, if you have to just do fewer moves in the first place, that's a huge advantage.
So it's interesting. I attended a class at Williams College during a parent weekend that was called, you know, the math behind the Rubik's Cube. And there was a high school boy, a local high school boy, that came in and did it for us in less than 8 seconds. I think he was the fastest person in that geographical area to do it. But I sat through the whole mathematical explanation of the Rubik's Cube, and I still couldn't tell you what it's all about. So maybe you can take us through a bit of that and, you know, what Mr. Rubik was thinking back in that his mother's apartment in Hungary back in 74.
Sure. Well, just to address Mr. Rubik, he's a bit like his own puzzle in that if you ask 10 different people the same question, you get 10 different answers. But the math of it is very complicated on paper, but many elements of it are actually very intelligible or even something we interact with in our daily lives. The branch of math that's most related to is called group theory, which shows up a lot when you're dealing with large sets of data. So it's something that's, you might encounter if you're a software engineer or even if you're using software. But you can see it in your own life in the sense that, say, conjugation is an element or operation in group theory, and it takes a mathematical form, bear with me for just a second, of A prime, meaning an operation, another operation, and the inverse of the first operation. But really, this is just the same thing as getting a sandwich out of your fridge, because you're opening the fridge door, which is your first operation, you're getting another sandwich out, which is the second operation, and then you're closing the fridge door. And the advantage is that you get to keep the integrity of the fridge. So, you know, you could take a pickaxe to the fridge and get the sandwich out, but you wouldn't have a fridge afterward. And in the same way, when you're solving the cube, sometimes maybe there's something you want to change, but you don't want to mess up everything you've already done. So this is a technique that allows you to alter what you have already built without ultimately taking it apart.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Ian Scheffler, who's written Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast, and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. All right, Ian, it's time to tell us, what is your record time?
So my best, in competition, you actually have two times. You have your best single time and your best average, and my best single is 16 seconds and change.
Oh, God.
So it's not world class, but it's, you know, nothing to sneeze at, so...
Absolutely.
Well, you've totally blown Lynn and I away. We just wrestled with this thing like wrestling with a gorilla. But in Oliver Stone's biopic of Edward Snowden, he has this piece that shows Snowden identifying himself to some other people by solving the Rubik's Cube. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so that's actually, as far as I'm aware, entirely true. Mr. Snowden used to walk around the halls of the NSA outpost he was in Hawaii carrying a Rubik's Cube. It was like his thing. And it's kind of an interesting metaphor for him trying to deal with this behemoth of the national security state, or however you want to read it. But he really did identify himself to those journalists by saying, you know, look for the man trying to solve a Rubik's Cube. And it's just kind of an interesting manifestation of how the cube has taken on this role in society as this metaphor for so many other things. You know, it shows up in movies, you know, op-eds about, you know, tension in the Middle East. I've seen it in, even in the movie WALL-E, where it's kind of a stand-in for the long-gone days of human civilization. The robot finds one, you know, after humans have left the planet.
Interesting. So not only are you nearly a world-class Rubik's Cube solver, you're a storyteller and you're a journalist, and but you've always had this keen interest in, you know, math, science, and engineering. So your book is really about stories, and you do go through a lot of the famous Rubik's Cube solvers. Talk about some of those, like Will Smith, for example.
Right. So funnily enough, Will and I are only separated by 1 degree in terms of our cube connection, because I learned to solve the cube at a summer camp years and years ago when I happened to sit next to the greatest Rubik's Cube solver in the world. I didn't know that's what he was. He could just do it under the table without hardly looking at it. And he was actually hired to teach Will Smith for the film, The Pursuit of Happiness. And this didn't make it into the book, but I did speak to the producers of that film, and originally they were just going to have it, you know, editing techniques make it look like Will Smith could solve the cube. But apparently Will's very competitive, and when he got wind of this, he adamantly said, I want to learn to do this, and I'm going to do it faster than your fancy editing techniques can do it. And he really did learn to solve it, and he later taught his son Jaden, who in a very Jaden Smith moment said at a press conference it was the best thing his father had ever taught him, because the Rubik's Cube will, and I quote, teach you about life itself.
Oh, I love that. So how does it teach you about life itself? Because John and I need to learn this.
Right. So it's actually interesting kind of in the context of what your previous guest, Samantha, was talking about, in the sense that, you know, the modern world is such a complex place, right? You sort of try to change one thing, something else changes, everything seems so connected. And the cube is very much like that, in that it's impossible to change anything without changing something else. There's a lot of philosophical lessons kind of embedded in it, which I start to get into in the book. And it also is ultimately a more meditative pursuit than I think an outsider would realize. It's doing it over and over, because every solve is different. You never get the same configuration twice when you start, because it's just so complicated. it's almost like passing rosary beads or doing some kind of moving meditation, and it gets into a very interesting psychological headspace where the faster you go, the slower it feels. It's a pretty trippy experience.
Because you say in the book that for you, the road to sub 20 was not just about memorizing algorithms or even solving the cube, but as you've learned from gurus that have crossed your path from pint-sized kids to engineering professor, it's about learning to solve yourself. What did this mean to you personally?
Right. So I would set this goal of trying to solve a cube under 20 seconds. This is sort of the 4-minute mile of solving a Rubik's Cube. And I never thought I'd be able to do it. I have now, to my own amazement, continually. But, you know, it's like you can learn to solve a Rubik's Cube watching a YouTube video and do it that same day. But doing it fast is a totally different beast in the sense that you can, you know, follow certain steps, but if you're trying to do it fast, you have to be able to think on your feet in such an interesting way. A Hungarian psychologist has called this flow, where you sort of enter a different mental state where you're so in tune with the moment that time itself kind of expands and you're at your most productive. And so that's a really hard place to get to, especially if you're on stage in front of hundreds of people with sweaty fingers trying to solve a Rubik's Cube.
That's fascinating. You also mentioned that that there was a class for this at UC Berkeley. It's a popular mathematics class. It's called Learn to Solve the Rubik's Cube. A lot of kids sign up for that?
Yeah, I mean, they often have to turn people away. I had the good fortune of showing up on the day of the midterm, which was a pretty funny experience because it's a very simple class in the sense that for the final, you have to solve the cube or you fail. And for the midterm, you have to solve 2/3 of the cube or you fail. And every year, there's kids who think they can cram for the final and they fail because you can't learn to cram a Rubik's Cube solve. They teach kids how to solve it. It's in this big lecture hall. I showed up at first and I didn't see anybody. And then literally when the bell rings, suddenly everyone pulls out a Rubik's Cube. And I was just surrounded by, you know, people very nervously practicing their motions.
That's so funny. So the propensity towards, you know, solving a Rubik's Cube and being attracted to doing that. I mean, I remember in the 80s in junior high school, there were some kids who drifted towards it and others who never picked it up. And it's showing, as you say, some sort of intellectual prowess, perhaps, or maybe it's just showing the way that a certain minds work. I mean, can all of our minds lead us into solving the Rubik's Cube?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the people I speak to in the book, one of the things he says is like, you know, not only can anyone learn to solve a Rubik's Cube, anyone can do it under 20 seconds. You just have to put in the time and the effort. You know, and it took me quite a while, so it wasn't a walk in the park. You know, if you have more talent, like the best Rubik's Cube solver in history is an Australian young man named Felix Zemdegs, and within 2 months he was under 20 seconds. So he's kind of like the Mozart of Rubik's Cube, or maybe the Usain Bolt is more appropriate, but you know, anyone definitely can learn to do it. It's just kind of the challenge of overcoming yourself, as we said earlier.
Lynn, we should have Ian back on the show for some other topics. As you, with your interest in math, science, and engineering, you were in a team in 2008 that won the U.S. Department of Energy's National Science Bowl. It's a Jeopardy-style competition. Tell us about that. That's fascinating. We would love to see that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting... So this started back in the, I think, late 80s or early 90s. The Department of Energy, I guess, to foster an interest in these subjects among youth, they ran a competition like Jeopardy, except you're on teams and, you know, you answer questions like, you know, what's the purpose of sodium dodecyl sulfate in a lab, which is a fact I'll never forget now because I got points for it. It's a molecular detergent that you use to untangle DNA in a cell because it's normally all bunched up, and if you want to react on it, you need more surface area. It's kind of arcane stuff like that.
And you remember it because you were not able to get that answer correct, or you had the answer?
Oh, no. I nailed that one in the national finals. I'll never forget it because my way of memorizing these things was making flashcards. And I think after we won, I weighed them all, and I had 22 and a half pounds of them.
Oh, boy. My mother used to put together flashcards for me. I was a slow learner, but didn't have 22 pounds, but they help out, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, and we were different folks. You know, like one of my teammates who's getting a PhD in computer science now, he would just kind of whiz through textbooks. And then our chemistry guy liked to have more practical lessons. So he once synthesized thermite in the back of the classroom, which is a compound used in underwater welding, and he evacuated half the school.
That's great. So
he really wanted to see the color.
Yeah, there we go. I'm always fascinated by people who, and as we know more about the brain, we know that this whole left brain, right brain thing is not as firm as we once thought it to be. But we, for example, from time to time, talk to the editor at Discover Magazine, Bill Andrews, who was a math major at MIT and changed to become the only English major graduating at MIT. And you sound like you're a scientist, but you're really a journalist. So, you know, talk about that a little bit. I find that to be interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny. And when I was a university student, I was either studying environmental biology or literature because they didn't give me enough years to do both so that I could, you know, very well have wound up working on a preserve in Kenya studying primates or something. So, you know, I think that, yeah, these subjects certainly are not as separate as we sometimes think they are. The Rubik's Cube is a prime example. The man who invented it, Erno Rubik, is the son of one of Hungary's most famous engineers and a poet. And, you know, he's just as interested in literature as he is in science. He counts among his influences everyone from Michelangelo to Isaac Asimov to, like, you know, I got to meet him in the book, which was a rare opportunity. And one of the first things he talked to me about was about an artist who'd been inspired by Rubik's Cube.
Oh, how about that? So it inspires creativity, would you say, or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually I learned through the course of this book that there's a whole community of people who do, well, not always connected to each other, who do make art inspired by the cube. There's a French artist named Invader, who's sort of like the Banksy of France, this anonymous street artist, who actually makes visual, basically paintings out of Rubik's Cube, just mosaics. He'll twist and turn them so that each square becomes a pixel, and he'll make essentially a painting. He'll recreate works of Western art. He'll do album covers, things like that.
What is next for you? What are you working on right now?
A whole bunch of stuff. I'm working on a screenplay about life at the Olympics. Behind the scenes, I'm working on a book about climate change, which will take a while to put together. I'm working on a book review right now about a book about the life and death of the Great Lakes. So keeping myself busy.
Yeah.
You absolutely are. Tell me this, Ian. Do you look at the Rubik's Cube when you're solving it? Do you have to look at it?
You do. So the Rubik's Cube, because it's different every single time you solve it. Well, actually, I should say you can look at it and then close your eyes and solve it. I'm learning to do that. It's possible to solve it entirely blindfolded. I haven't mastered that yet. Although the world record for that is now just 18 seconds combining memorization and solving. But it's sort of like one of those games people play on their phones where you're running really fast and you're trying to dodge obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
When you're speed solving, it's like that. You're going really fast and you're like, oh, what's here? What's at this stage? You know, do I have to turn right here, turn left here? Like you're trying to make really, really quick decisions about that.
So say you're in your 50s and you missed that whole first wave of the Rubik's Cube popularity back in the 80s and you want to start. You want to go out to the toy store and buy a Rubik's Cube. Do you suggest trying to solve it on your own, or do you suggest, I mean, what do you say? Is going to YouTube kind of cheating in some way?
Well, it sort of depends on what you're looking for. I mean, I've interviewed hundreds of people in the world of Rubik's Cubes and puzzles, and I've only met, you know, a handful who learned to solve it on their own. You know, obviously one was the man who invented it because he had no choice. It was either he could solve it or pretty much no one can. But, you know, no one should deny themselves that experience if they really want to try it. There's, you know, I in some ways do regret that I never, you know, since I learned it as a kid, I never had that moment of just clarity where it's like, wow, I figured this out, even if it isn't the most efficient solution. So, you know, certainly give it a crack. But if your goal is to solve it fast, that's an experience where it's almost like you start on this journey that never ends. That's why I'm still finding myself late at night sometimes. I'll be like, oh, I'm just going to do a few solves to keep my hand in it. And then an hour later, I'm like, you know, just a few more. Because the moment you get that taste of, you know, you can get faster, you know that you can always keep getting faster. You know, even if the best guy in the world who can solve it in under 5 seconds says he can improve, then, you know, I can certainly improve too.
Ian Scheffler, who's written Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast, and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. Ian, before we let you go, how old is Erno Rubik, and is he still making puzzles?
So Erno's in his early 70s, and yeah, he is still tinkering away with things. He, in the last 15 years, has had a couple of new kind of variants on the Rubik's Cube, something called the Rubik's 360 come out. So he's very much an active, still an active person in the world of design and puzzles, and he's also a practicing architect.
Very good.
And you interviewed him. You're one of the few people who has, it sounds like.
Yeah, it took me about 2 years to get a one-hour lunchtime interview with him, and I went all the way to Hungary and still wasn't sure it would happen. But that was, for me, one of the highlights of the research.
Ian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ian.
Okay. And this is Cool Science Radio, KPCW in Park City. When we return, Suzanne Scragg and Hogle Zoo in Salt Lake, who's been prepping kids in Park City all week for the arrival of Jeff Corwin at the Eccles Center this Saturday. Stay with us.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, KPCW supporter, providing personalized knee and shoulder care, focusing on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing, and now incorporating stem cell therapy. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
This is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Well, wasn't that interesting about the Rubik's Cube? Are you going to run out and get one?
You and I are both going shopping after the program.
I know. When my kids did it in high school, say 5 years ago, in junior high, they could do it in about a minute. They got down to about a minute. And at that time, they said, oh, you can do this too, Mom. And you know, they gave me a few tips, and it just didn't catch. So I think I will try the YouTube.
Now that you've been doing Cool Science Radio for 3.5 years, You and I are pumped. We're ready to go.
That's right. Okay, well, finally, celebrity wildlife biologist Jeff Corwin, who's best known for his Emmy Award-winning shows on Animal Planet and Discovery. You know him. He combines humor and adventure in a wildly fun and conservation-themed show. He'll be at the Eccles Center on March 11th, that Saturday, and joining us now from the Hogle Zoo to talk about how kids in the Park City School District have been prepped, I think, during this week for the show coming up on Saturday, is Suzanne Scraggin. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And also Mo Hickey, who's managing director of the Park City Institute.
Morning.
Nice to have you both.
Thanks for having us.
So what do you do at the Hogle Zoo, Suzanne?
I'm the academic and community programs manager, so I'm in the education department, and I oversee a lot of our outreach programs to schools around the state.
Okay, and so how did you hook up with the whole Jeff Corwin show? I mean, obviously, if you work at Hogle Zoo, you're a Jeff Corwin fan.
Yes, we are. In fact, we have a book club, and we read one of his books last year for our book club at the zoo. But the Park City Institute called us, and it was a perfect fit. You know, we're all about animals and conservation, and so is Jeff. So we signed up immediately to help out.
And so prior to many Eccles shows, we do community outreach, and a lot of that outreach happens in elementary schools, secondary schools, and it's a wonderful thing. Mo, talk a little bit about the outreach and how often it happens.
It happens anytime we actually can make the schedule work. I mean, everybody we book, we actually try to have some form of outreach with them. Sometimes it's their schedule, meaning the performer, that doesn't work out, or sometimes it might be the school schedule. Like over the recent President's Week break, we had two groups that would have done student outreach, but students weren't in school. But for the most part, if the students are in school, in session, and the artist is getting in on Friday morning, we always have a student outreach. So we've had everything ranging from musicians, dancers, authors. We've had, when we had Edward Snowden last year, we had his ACLU attorney spent over 4.5 hours with students at the high school talking about legal issues, which to me was fascinating. But this year, I just did this because we're getting a grant ready. In 2016 and 17 to date, we've had 8,000 students come through student outreach.
Wow.
So Jeff Corwin will be at the Eccles Center this Saturday night.
He'll be at the Eccles Center Saturday night at 7:30.
7:30, okay. And what can people expect that are going to be attending?
Well, I remember when he was here last time, so it's a fun show. He will be bringing animals with him. The animals are en route from, I believe, your old neck of the woods in Massachusetts right now. They're in transit. So we don't know what animals he'll have with him. It's a surprise to us as well. But it's a combination of there's a lot of fun with the show. There's also a lot of there's an educational component to it. Jeff is very big on, as Lynn mentioned, conservation and habitat. So he'll be educating the audience on that, as well as being very interactive between the audience himself, a little bit with the animals at times. We were trying to remember the other day, was it him or Jack Hanna, where the kangaroo ran around the Eccles Center?
That was Jack Hanna.
That was Jack Hanna. You were there for that one. Okay, good. Well, you can confirm it. That was the argument.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you, Suzanne, you've been an animal fan for a long time.
Yes.
And so talk about being, you know, sort of the runner-up to Jeff Corwin. That's a little pressure, isn't it?
It's a little pressure. I'm really glad I get to go ahead of him instead of having to follow that act. But it was lots of fun. We went to Jeremy Ranch Elementary on Tuesday, and we took a lot of native Utah animals for the kids to see, and then we let Jeff bring in the big exotic ones, or whatever he's bringing.
Yeah, so which native animals? You took these in cages, I suppose? And
These are animals we can actually handle, and we take out to schools on a regular basis. That's what they do for a living. So we had a desert tortoise, we had a kestrel, which is a small falcon, we had a snake and a lizard and a tarantula and all kinds of fun stuff.
Do the kids, are they allowed to have the tarantula crawl on them? I remember that as a kid.
Yeah, we don't think that's a really safe or responsible way to do things, but they are able to touch some of the animals. So the lizard, the tortoise, the snake, these are all things that they could touch, but the other things they got to see up close, which they don't normally get to see. Maybe they fly past when you're outside, but you don't get to really look at them up close.
So we're not getting outreach from Jeff Corwin himself this time.
No, he won't be in town. He won't be here in time to do student outreach, which is why it's a great partnership. And it was really a fun day with the Hogle Zoo. And, you know, it was, I think we had 5 second grade classes, so they were the perfect age. Especially, you know, my favorite part was the kestrel, which had been taken from its nest, I guess the story.
Yeah, all of the birds of prey we have at the zoo are rehab birds that were unable to re-release into the wild. And some of them were ones people thought, oh, they'd make a great pet. And then it's not legal for one thing, but they don't make a great pet. So they end up with rehabbers.
And this is a hawk.
It's a small falcon. So people call them a sparrow hawk because they're very small little falcons, but they're very common around.
Okay.
Once you know what to look for.
Boy, I'm curious to see what Jeff brings with him for Saturday.
Any idea, any firm animals that we know?
Honestly, no.
No.
That's kind of part of the show is that he will bring what he brings. And
well, from
and
Boston,
surprises.
could be a Pats fan or something.
We're not going to go there, are we?
Oh, I'm kind of wild animals.
Oh, can't we?
No matter what topic astrophysics, black holes, whatever, it all comes back to the Patriots.
Or the Red Sox. But Jeff is from, I think, Norwood, Massachusetts. I don't know where he lives now. Probably somewhere in the Boston area.
Well, he's got to be a Pats fan then.
Yeah.
You could bring Tom Brady with him. That'd be okay with me.
Oof. Oh, yeah.
So, Suzanne, how long have you been with Hogle Zoo?
I've been there for 14 years on staff, and I actually started as a volunteer when I was 13 years old. So I've been there a long time.
Oh, absolutely. So an event like this for you, Jeff Corwin coming here, you know, what does that mean to you?
It's really exciting. You know, in college, that's when the Crocodile Hunter and Jeff Corwin were most popular. And I watched all their shows. I always wanted to work with animals and with kids. So I was going to be a high school teacher. But they maybe gave me that little nudge to go over to the zoo side and be a teacher there instead. So they're out there spreading the same conservation message that we're trying to spread at the zoo. You know, Jeff is very big into conservation. He's written books and he does a lot of TV work to work with zoos on that.
Talk a little bit about the modern day zoo. No doubt that zoos have in recent times gotten a bad rap sometimes for the way animals are held in captivity. What's the current thinking on making a zoo, you know, having it operate in such a way that is expanding our knowledge and our experience of animals so that we will, you know, be more likely to be conservation-minded ourselves? You know, just talk about it a little bit. I know there's a lot of controversy surrounding it.
There is controversy, but a modern zoo, a true modern zoo, is a conservation center. We're not primarily there for recreation, if that's how the public views us, but we're there for conservation and education. We're there to teach people about the animals and help them form that personal connection. You know, if you've never seen the desert tortoise or the kestrel up close, or you've never seen a snow leopard or a rhino, it's really hard to care about them when they're this abstract thing that's far away. So we give people that opportunity to form that connection, but we also also put a lot of money and time and staff into conservation work both here in Utah and throughout the world. We belong to the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is an accrediting body where we're required to do conservation and education work. And AZA Zoos, I think, put $120 million into conservation in the last several years. So we're really putting our money where our mouth is, and we're walking the walk at modern zoos.
Mo, how do people get tickets for Saturday night's event?
They can get tickets online at www.ecclescenter.org. The box office is open today, tomorrow, 10 to 5, at the Eccles Center next to the high school. And Saturday, the box office opens at noon. Tickets start at $19. And we, as with all of our shows, we have $5 student tickets. So it's a for me, the $5 student ticket is a great bargain for kids to be able to come and see a show like Jeff Corwin.
Yeah, give us a snapshot of what's coming up besides the show on Saturday.
After this, we have we have our annual fundraiser, Saints and Sinners, on St. Patrick's Day up at the St. Regis, which is a fun night. And there's still a few very limited tickets left for that. We have Ballet West coming up from Salt Lake. They're going to be debuting a new piece on March 18th. We have Taj Mahal coming. We have the two women that do the Serial podcast. They'll be here. That's going to be a really fun night. We have John McCune, formerly Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, but he's had a local presence in the past here in Park City. And we'll be finishing up the season middle of April with Nellie Mackay, which is she's going to be doing a show called A Girl Named Bill, which is based on a true story of a musician who lived basically his whole life in a different gender that people thought they was as a singer.
Wow, interesting.
So she's going to be a really fun performance.
Showtime on Saturday, 7:30. It's Jeff Corwin. Are we going to see, is the audience going to be made up of, 80% kids? Or is there sort of a serious portion to the show that appeals to adults? I'm thinking, a bit of a lecture on conservation and that sort of thing. Or is it all sort of based around what kids would love?
Oh, I'm sure it'll be great for adults, too. I'm planning on being there. All of us who went to college and watched Jeff and went into careers in science because of Jeff, we'll be there for sure, and it'll be a great show.
Yeah, I was looking at the numbers yesterday, actually, and we're about 60-40 adults to what I'd call students.
Okay.
So it's a nice mix. It's a family show.
Yeah.
And I think everybody will enjoy it for different reasons, depending on your age.
All right. Well, thank you both for coming in. We're speaking with Mo Hickey, the managing director of the Park City Institute, and Suzanne Scraggin of the Hogle Zoo. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, guys.
And we'll be back after these words.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch Counties.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio today. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Want to thank our guests, Sumanth Subramanian, who talked to us about fake news in Macedonia, then the Rubik's Cube, Ian Scheffler, and finally Suzanne Scraggin and Mo Hickey in to talk about Jeff Corwin at the Eccles Center on Saturday. We want to thank our underwriters, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Davidson Orthopedics, Peak Art and Frame, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, San Francisco Design. We have a few seconds remaining. Some cool story you have in your brain.
Well, we certainly know that NASA put men on the moon, and the program's now going to Mars and looking at other planets and those sorts of things. But they also spend a lot of time looking at our own planet. And since 1967, they've been studying our planet. Here's six things that they say we may not know about snow. Snow covers 30% of land on Earth. More than 1.2 billion people rely on water from snowpack and glaciers. And since 1967, a million square miles of spring snow cover has disappeared. That is the equivalent of California, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and Arizona. NPR National News is next. Everybody go outside and have a great day.